From Albuquerque this week, I'm Joey Peters.
I'm Matthew Reichbach.
And I'm Hakeem Bellamy.
And that's our guest today on the Weekly Word, the Albuquerque's Poet Laureate, Hakeem Bellamy. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
So we're gonna talk about your work, your body of work, what it's like to be a poet laureate. What does a poet laureate do?
I'm still trying to figure that out.
And we'll talk about all that. We'll have him read some poetry, too, and we'll do that right after this break.
And we're back, and once again, we're here with Hakeem Bellamy, Poet Laureate of Albuquerque, named Poet Laureate last year, correct?
Last year. 2012, right? What year are we in, Joey?
13, yeah. So last year, and you've been doing slam poetry for 8 years in northern New Mexico.
I have.
So can you tell us how that started?
Man, it was a unlikely sequence of events, I like to say. You know, I moved out here for school at UNM, and I'd heard about performance poetry or slam poetry from a college roommate of mine when I was going to school in North Carolina. She brought in a VHS, that's how old I am, of Deaf Poetry Jam. And as the first time I'd seen poets doing something that was kind of like what I did, which is somewhere between Page, Barnes & Noble's poetry reading and hip-hop. It was like something in the middle that was really performative and really rhythmic, in my opinion. And I watched that and I was like, wow, there's a place where people are doing what I'm doing. That's cool. But I still didn't like seek it out till I moved home to Philly and there were no slams there. But Philly has a huge, fantastic art scene. And there was First Fridays, like art gallery openings, and you could go hear poets, amazing poets, do their thing. And it wasn't until I moved to Albuquerque that I actually was in a city that had a slam. Philadelphia has a phenomenal slam team now, but not when I was there. That had a slam, and I just kind of showed up, and you know, the rest is history, kind of.
Who can you tell me who your influences are, or what? I mean, so you're saying back in college you kind of started watching Deaf Poetry Jam, but before that you were saying they're kind of doing two things that you liked there, and what got you into those two? Who are your influences?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I grew up on hip hop, and so I always say that like my entree to poetry was literally through music. Like I liked, you know, I'm 35, so a lot of my early influences in hip hop were Common, back then Common Sense,
yeah.
Tribe Called Quest, De La Soul, even like Public Enemy, X-Clan and things like that. And I knew that if I wanted to like master language and be a better writer or rapper at the time, because that's what me and my friends would do in the back of a car with like a tape, we'd just sit there with instrumentals and rap. I knew that I had to start reading more, right? You know, I had to start, it's like language in, language out, right? And so I started to pick up more books around various topics, and my mom drops this Khalil Gibran book on me one day in high school, and I'm like, whatever, and it like stick it on the bookshelf and go away to college. And I think my second year of college, I came home and actually pulled that book off the shelf and was like, check out this guy. Like, this is amazing. He's talking about life. He's talking about his country. He's talking about politics and in these very beautiful ways. It just was really interesting to me that book that was given to me earlier started to matter at a certain point in my life.
Uh-huh.
And that's what really made me think, man, words on the page are powerful too. I should do that. And I just kind of started doing it for myself, like writing Word documents and saving them. It wasn't anything I shared with anybody until my third year of college.
So you're kind of answering my next question, which is why not just rap?
I think it's a different form. You know, I think that there's a different audience. Certainly what I like about rap and hip hop is that I get an audience of people that might not ever show up at a poetry reading. And so I get to translate what I'm trying to express and emote and communicate into code. Like, you know, musical code is essentially what I'm doing. But then I get to have a different dialogue and different engagement, tell a different story with different images through poetry to a totally different audience sometimes that may not relate to me generationally, that may not relate to me where I grew up at, my ethnic background and things of that nature, but they're listening and they're hearing my story. And I really do think of it as puzzle building. Like I'm trying to say, for this audience, I need to frame it like this and get it to them that way. For this audience, I need to frame it like that and get it to them that way.
And you said when you came back to Albuquerque, that's when you started doing slam poetry. What kind of scene was around back, and what year was that?
Oh, man, you know, I hate to be like one of those young old guys who are like, oh, it was back in the day, the golden years, it was great. But it was like when I moved here, that was like the pinnacle of the Albuquerque poetry community. There were years of work that poets put in before I kind of just, you know, showed up on the scene, right place, right time. But we were hosting the National Poetry Slam that year in 2005. So there was a whole lot of energy, resources, money. The city was behind it. People who didn't ever really care about poetry before were packing out venues in Albuquerque. And I walked in literally on Martin Luther King Day, Martin Luther King's birthday in 2005. And I slammed a couple of weeks later, like the first week of February, and won my first slam. I was really fortunate because that doesn't really happen. And then I was already half qualified for the city team. And by April, I was the city champ. And by August, we were national champions. And I was like just along for the ride. So I have to give it up to my teammates, Ken Rodriguez, our teammate and coach, Carlos Contreras, Aaron Cuffey, and Esme Von Drager for a summer of hard work and fun.
Yeah, I think I remember they put that on KUNM, right?
Yes. Poetry.
I think I remember listening to that in my room up in Rio Rancho.
No doubt. They had it was cool because they like had a live like sports broadcast of the poetry event, and they had Taylor Molly, who's like a slam god, a giant in the slam scene of sorts. He was also on the broadcast.
And then
Marv Alberts, you know, John Madden. No, not really,
Pat Summerall was there.
Right.
So from there, like what happened after you guys won the national championship? Like what happened with the scene? What happened with you?
What happened, right? So here, first thing that happened, Matthew, was I called my mom the next day and I was like, we won a national poetry slam. My mom was kind of like, there's like a dead silence where she's like, what's that? She's like, do you have to go to work tomorrow? And I'm like, thanks, Mom. Appreciate it. Like, I thought we just conquered the world, and everybody's like, back to life. But that's really what it was. Like, it was like back to life as usual. Like, we were a young team. Ken was still writing, I think, was still a reporter. And the rest of us were like in school full time. So everybody went back to kind of their normal lives. But then it did start to pick up. Like, we were being asked to do educational presentations, do performances around the state, and then asked to do performances in other parts of the country. And we were in New York, I think, the following year for the Brave New Voices, and we performed at the New Eurekan Poets Cafe, and then we were in LA the summer, or not LA, in Monterey the summer before. So we were kind of starting to move around and really get our work out there, which was a privilege because we felt like we were letting these larger cities know that, you know, Southwest has a voice, and we're talking about stuff in our poetry that matters to people here, which is foreign to a lot of people in the larger cities sometimes. And then it just, for me personally, I was on a couple more slam teams in 2006, 2008, and 2010. And I kind of hung up my slam boots because I wanted to experiment with longer form and theater work and more. I got more into music and stuff. But I kept working my craft and publishing wherever I could. And that also made me more page-based, which was awesome. Like, I started putting words down on, and I started getting accepted to journals and web journals and anthologies. And I just took my writing to another level, I guess.
And you kind of went solo?
I went solo. Yeah, making a band. Yeah, I went solo. But I think everybody did. Like, it's great. I work with Carlos a lot now. Ken became Slam Master and just kind of retired from being Slam Master. So the Albuquerque Slam scene is in really good hands because it's in the hands of Aaron Cuffey and Damian Flores. And, you know, Cuffey was part of that team. Damian has been slamming here forever, and he's a favorite son of Albuquerque and a really phenomenal poet. And so Esme went to school to Hampshire, and now she's back. And so we all kind of VH1 making a band. Like, where are they 10 years later? Like,
So I want you to describe just a little bit about how you became the poet laureate of the city down here last year.
And what a poet laureate is.
And what a laureate is. Yeah, that's usually the first question. So let's say laureate. A laureate is what I like to boil it down to is the poet of record. You know, there's a storied history of laureates and actual, like, laurels, like record room and laurels being thrown out. That's not in the budget. Me and the mayor talked about that. No laurel throwing when I'm walking up the street. But this idea that even during early Olympic Games times, the poet would kind of capture the moment and capture the event in words. And that was their job, is to kind of go around and be a troubadour of words, be a bard that kind of told the story, retold and captured the story of what was happening. And so historically, laureates around the world, whether it's a country laureate or a state laureate or a municipality laureate, that's generally their job, is to live and, you know, take a Polaroid with your phrase, take a Polaroid with your poem, and share it with the community. And hopefully you reflect the community, not as a special person, but as like an everyday person observing everyday things, right? And so that's generally the job. In a more ceremonial sense, I am asked by the city at certain occasions to come up with poems that I will read at those public events. And then the job as the ambassador, which is really the biggest part to me, is where do I take poetry, right? So there's people that show up at poetry slams, like my kind of people, who, you know, they understand the value of poetry. They know what it means to them. They understand the quality of life that it helps you out with and all that good stuff and the community it builds. And then there's people who, like, haven't read a poem since eighth grade. So my job is to do poetry that connects to them.
Right.
People who, like, otherwise don't think it matters in their lives. And it certainly doesn't mean you're the best poet. There's poets here that I look up to and worship. And I always like to remind people that this is not a who's the best poet position. If you want to do that, you can go win the book award for poetry and show how good you are. In this position, it's more like who's willing to serve and how can you serve? How can you reach as many people as possible through poetry and make it matter?
So can you tell us, like, what are some events that you've gone to and, you know, prepared poems for the city or for the community around here?
The most notable, which I still am humbled by because it was a really hard task. I was really challenged by the opportunity to present this poem, but it was the centennial poem. So, you know, New Mexico turned 100 last year. And I always say we turned 100 in the eyes of the United States because people were here before that, right? But we celebrated that centennial in Civic Plaza in Albuquerque, and the mayor asked me to write a poem for the centennial. And so I was like, man. So I've only been here 8 years. I'm this dude from New Jersey. Like, I didn't grow up here. So who am I to even try to, like, write this poem? And the mayor was like, I really want you to do it. And that was even before I was poet laureate. And then once I became poet laureate, it's like, okay, now you have to do it. So get over it. Like, you know, and I kind of ran from it. I was kind of scared of it, but I knew I couldn't do it alone. So I did my research. I did my homework. And I spoke to people like Damian Flores, who as a poet, I respect him, but also as a historian and a native son of Albuquerque. Levi Romero, who's the centennial poet and also happens to be on my thesis committee. I was like, Levi, what do I do? Like, you know, he's from Dixon, you know what I'm saying, New Mexico. So these guys kind of gave me some pointers, and Levi brought me a stack of books. And one of those books was on corridos, and I was really attached to this idea of folk storytelling, historical songs, legendary kind of epic songs. And then at the end of the breakfast, Levi's like, but what you really need to do is go have conversations. Like, talk to older octogenarian New Mexicans who've been here, find their stories, and then find yourself in a story. I think I was intimidated because I was like, who am I to write this as someone who's not from here? And he was like, don't try to write the poem like you're a New Mexican. Write the poem like you're a black dude from Philadelphia who moved there and moved here, and tell us what you love about New Mexico. And so I took all that, and I still, like, had writer's block like crazy. And it wasn't until I flew home Christmas of last year, or Christmas the year before, because I did it previous June. When I flew home that Christmas and I was leaving Albuquerque, like leaving the Sunport, we're breaking the cloud line. And it's weird that when you leave someplace, that's when you miss it most. And all these feelings started rushing to me. And I was like, I need a piece of paper. I got to write this down. But we hadn't got to the right elevation where I could put my laptop out or they would have kicked me off the plane. So I'm like writing it in my head. And then finally I'm like, ch-ch-ch. And I literally was typing it while I was flying home from Albuquerque. And it went over well. People really seemed to like it and connect to it and say I did a good job capturing.
So it sounds like, you know, it was like 6 months in advance that you're writing this.
Oh, yeah.
How long does it take to write a poem? Like, what's your process usually?
It's a research project for me. Like, I'm very much a research poet, so I'll just immerse myself in information until I find an angle that is interesting. Like, I think for me, it's one thing to be really good and creative with language and wow people with that. I don't think I wow people with that. One day I will, as I get older. I think what I do, though, is I try to find an interesting approach to the information or the subject matter. And I think if it's interesting enough that people will care, like, oh, I never thought of it that way, or never looked at it that way, or never heard of it that way, that then they'll stick with me for the next 2 minutes or 3 minutes or 4 minutes of the poem, if I can get them, you know, with the kind of perspective. And I think that's what I do. Like, I swim in information until I say, now that's an interesting angle to explore. And that usually kind of precipitates the writing for me. At that point, I feel like the poem writes itself, but I could spend months being like, I don't want to do it that way. People have done that before. That's boring. And I'll just go through. And then finally, like, a particular piece of information will come, you know, to my awareness. And I'll be like, oh, that's interesting. I should write about that. That's a great angle to write about. So,
mm-hmm. What are some of the subject matters you like to tackle a lot in your poetry?
Man, I always say, you know, personal experience. And what's interesting about that in New Mexico is that my personal experience is unignorably that of a young African-American male in America. So I do write a lot about race, which I always find interesting in a state that has, you know, as of the 2010 census, roughly 2% African-American population. But I learned a long time ago through great poet mentors that it's one thing to tell people something they already know, and it's another thing to kind of help people see the world through your eyes. And so I generally try to do it in a way that's more storytelling. And it's interesting because I was just having a conversation with a friend. I was like, people show up to hear me do my work. And sometimes it's about challenging stuff. It's about stuff that we like to run away from and ignore until, you know, a Zimmerman Martin thing happens. And then we have to talk about it. And then it goes away. Like, you know, but I write about it all the time because that's unignorably part of my existence. And it's, I'm reminded every day by society that I'm black. So I write about that a lot. But it's just interesting. I feel humbled that people feel that it could be something challenging that we engage together, and that's uncomfortable sometimes for all of us, but we can do it in a way that's healing. We can do it in a way that creates conversations. We can do it in a way that creates awareness and aha moments and hugs and crying and, you know, and all that good stuff. So,
so like, what kind of response do you get now that you're kind of more recognized around town than like when you were first starting, when you first came back from Philly?
Sure. It's cool because I feel like overwhelmingly I get a lot of love. Albuquerque's been exceptionally good to me and kind to me. New Mexico's been kind to me. And I don't know. I always say this, and this is where like my hometown Philly people probably get mad at me. I don't know if I would have had the same platform or the same opportunity in Philadelphia just because it's in those larger cities, sometimes there's much more separation and the glass ceiling between genres of art and certainly who you know as opposed to what you know in bigger cities. And
yeah,
here people
kind of big cities, they each have their own little niche.
Yeah.
Here it's like, well, everybody's kind of has a finger in this and this and this.
Exactly. Like I for example, I always say I got to do poetry with, you know, the New Mexico Symphony Orchestra through Church of Beethoven or now Chatter. And I just don't think that in reality, I don't know this, but that in reality, a Philadelphia street poet, if you will, would get a chance to work with the Philadelphia Philharmonic. Like, I just don't, there's much more, there's lots of more hurdles and red tape and separation and people going to their camps than there is here. So there's lots of opportunity. So I'm lucky. But also on the flip side, the more you share your work with a population or a number of people, you know, I also get like the people who are upset that I'm not five books in by the time I got to be poet laureate, or that it's a slam poet, and I put that in air quotes for you at home who can't see that, as if slam poetry is a genre other than anything that you just read at a slam, really, you know, and so it's, you know, you get that, but it's okay if that's an actual conversation that's happening, even if it's happening at my expense, you know.
So just as long as the dialogue is out there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so now that you're kind of, are you retired from slam poetry now, or do you go?
I consider myself retired, but who does that even mean anymore? Like, think about Michael Jordan or Eminem. Not
I guess
that I'm comparing
you didn't make
myself
a fortune
to
fortune.
Yeah, but they like, you retire, and then tomorrow you come back, and it's a media event for a day, and people are like. But I just, you know, for me, it's when I say that I kind of don't go to slams anymore, it's mainly a time thing. Like, I have a 5-year-old son, and I am blessed that I have the opportunity to share my poetry in lots of other venues, and I feel like the slam is a place where those emerging voices who don't have anywhere to go, like they're not necessarily being asked to present 2 or 3 times a week, they need the slam, and that space needs to be available to them to kind of earn their chops, get their chops, share their work, get feedback, and then grow into a poet who's being asked to present in other rooms and in other environments. And if I don't move out of the way, I'm just taking up space. That's honestly how I feel. So, you know?
Do the young poets, do they come to you and ask you advice, or do you give them advice?
I do, and I get to work with them. I do a lot of work with schools and young poets. So for me, it's always like, how do we create the next, like, how have I said it before? Like, I'm not necessarily going to be the next Martin Luther King or Malcolm X, but the work that we do is important because it creates the next Mandela, the next whoever, like, you know, and because we give them an opportunity to express themselves and work on their public speaking and their confidence, but also how they share ideas, how they move people, how they grow, like all that happens through poetry. And I get to do that with young poets. And, you know, if they can win a slam, great. If they don't win a slam, hopefully we gave them a tool that they can use for the rest of their life.
All right. Well, now you're going to read some poetry for us. So we get a good treat here. What is the poem you're going to read right now?
This poem is lovingly called Chronometrophobia, which means the fear of clocks.
Okay.
And it's a new one. Because she had always been on time, the foreman never so much as flinched at his forearm when she had to leave early. She's good labor. Not even a baby would make her late. 90 minutes later, I was born a month early. The lieutenant and my dad was proud that I was on time, military time, for the last time. Growing up, I was told that time is not a suggestion, it's a fact. Non-negotiable, so I guess that's why I'm anti-punctual, because clocks make me feel like a hostage with the way that they're armed. Skin-flavored nightmares every day at 12:30 of me as public enemy, neck dangling from an oversized clock. This is the face of chronometrophobia. I am on CP time, New Mexican and Indian time, and frankly, it's sad that that's still not enough time. I can barely keep up time, and it's so sad I still need more. The leash given me by God, family, and friends alone, never by appointment and employers, except for when I was 415 Hakeem on my name tag and schedule at Eddie Bauer. But I was proud when their manager proposal began with, "He may not come when you want him, but he always shows up." I'm not the type to call out. I'm a type that's running behind. Chasing my dreams makes me late for their reality. Chasing my future has me late for their now. So just know, when I show up a hair less dressed and stressed, it's simply because I haven't met my future yet. And when they say dumb shit like, "If you would have left 10 minutes earlier, all the lights would have been green," I know exactly what they mean. But when they say dumb shit like, "He's the type that would be late for his own funeral," I have no freaking idea what they mean. Of course I want to be late to my own funeral. Matter of fact, I'll be a friggin' no-show if I have any say in the matter. So what if I am too much heart hemmed up to a surplus of sleeve, never cufflinked to but covering my forearm foreman so I never know what time to leave? Plus, I already told you my phobia of clocks. They just remind me that we're all running out of time. And I'm sorry if I borrow a couple of your seconds to enjoy the ride. I'm sorry I try to love everybody at the same time and I didn't prioritize your deadline over my lifeline. I mean no disrespect and I don't mean to take your time, but I mean to take mine. When I'm late, I hear me ticking. Knowing that when I leave, I will not have spent as much time with you as I would have liked. Just like the conversation I haven't seen in forever at the market. The, "No, Mom, this is not a bad time" on the phone. The, "Yes, son, I have time for one more video game." The third snooze. The cuddle for breakfast. The best part of waking up is laying next to me in bed. The 5 more minutes won't hurt that made me late to this. "Hi, I'm now 15 Hakeem. Pleased to meet you. And I'm sorry I'm not embarrassed or ashamed. I feel relieved. Even though there certainly wasn't enough time to stop for bathroom or gas, I just drove 85 miles per hour from wherever I was to be in your presence. And I wish you were all arms and unconditional instead of frowns and perfection, because I'm not God. But just like the folk in the black church say about they God, he may not come when you want him, but he's on time."
Nice.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us today, Hakeem.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Oh, Joey has something else. Joey has requested another phone.
Joey has a request. I love requests. As long as it's not a karaoke request for me, because you don't want that. That could be bad, bad, bad.
Okay, we're going to play Journey.
I was just saying, one encore, if that's all right with
that's
you.
That's cool.
It could be a short one.
This one is shorter. It's much shorter. That was really a slam poem. Kind of when it was
epic. You said that was a new one you just read.
That was a new one. Yeah, I just got it memorized, so I haven't performed it often, but people who see me around will hear it more and more often.
That's the podcast debut of that
podcast
poem.
Debut, world premiere. But this one's shorter, and it actually was done for a project at the National Hispanic Cultural Center last year. Again, Levi Romero is a centennial poet, and he asked me to be part of a crew of poets who wrote poems about Bless Me Ultima. So when that was coming through here, they did a fabulous performance at the Chemo with Michelle Otero, and the movie was coming out, and it was all about Bless Me Ultima and Rudolfo Anaya's classic work. So this is called Bless Me. "No, Antonio, you are not broken. You will fix us in the places that miracles have failed and forgotten. Eastern New Mexico has been fighting long before World War II, and it's quite normal for war to make people lose their faith in everything. But you are fact, and where you are from is fertile. Here they harvest soldiers and priests for lunch, but you are cosmic, a constellation of culture that could tip the entire Llano towards the sun to get her attention, to remind her that we are her children, dying to get closer to her by bullet or belief. And you, Antonio, will concern yourself with the fate of every soul, while the church concerns itself with the fate of every pocket. Guadalupe is more than just your home, Antonio. It's where your heart is buried, beneath the beaten, beneath the beatings, beneath your classmates mocking you. Bless me, Antonio, beneath the beating earth pumping mud through our veins. I may be no virgin, but as sure as Juan Diego smelled the rose petals on Our Lady's breath, I will give you this Nahua, this language of healing and curanderismo, in hopes that you will find yourself, Antonio. And when you do, perhaps you will find your God curled up behind you. Protect him. Speak to him. In the tongue of the land I taught you, then tell him to pick up a shovel and saddle up, because there are too many miracles and not enough time, because this is the army the priest should have prayed for and the soldiers should have joined, because we need all the help we can get.
Very good. So that was in the voice of Ultima from...
Yes.
And
a persona piece.
How did you get involved in that project?
Levi had asked me, and I had already been kind of fascinated with the book because I had lived here so many years and I hadn't read the book, and I knew it was coming to the theater, so I was one of those people like, I'm going to read the book before I go see.
I've never read the book.
The play. Yeah, right? You know what I'm saying?
I read it like 2 months ago.
Did you? Yeah. So I was fascinated with, and I had started reading it when I was researching the Centennial poem before I met with Levi and Damien, but I hadn't finished it. And so I did finish it. And what I was smitten with is this idea of magical realism that they always attribute to Anaya. And it was a conversation I had with another author or poet that was like, that term is insulting. I was like, what do you mean? Because it's always the people who aren't the winners whose history is alternate. They're alternative historians as opposed to the dominant narrative that gets to get told. So when they call it magical realism, they're saying that what Rodolfo was writing or saw was not real. Like, you know, it's not real in the way that we think of things being real, though that's what he saw. So that was his reality. Mm. And then the other argument is that when we think about magical realism, that's actually how we remember. Like, so when we remember things or have dreams, it's not linear. It's crazy. Like, you know, things fly in your dreams that don't fly in real life. And that's how our memory is. It's kind of more snapshots than linear narrative. And so is it magical realism, or is it actually just memory set to words?
Sure. Yeah. Sure. And then the first poem you read before is about not being punctual.
Yes. Which I think New Mexicans relate to.
I think that Joey can relate with that.
It's crazy because I feel like when I say, like, talking about race, like you were saying, like, it's like, again, how do we use race to bring people together? And that's an experience that we share across many different racial designations, but it gets attributed to certain peoples. And so it's rather than just saying stereotypes are bad and black people aren't always late, I'd rather write a poem that people are like, dude, that's totally me, even when they're not black. Like, that's a better way to attack our differences is through our similarities, if you will. You know.
Sure, sure. Well, Hakeem, before you leave, do you have any public appearances or shows coming up you want to announce? Or?
I'm so bad at this. I should know better. But I do know since I believe Santa Fe is going to be listening, I'm up there quite a bit this month working with Santa Fe School for the Arts and Sciences. And I do a lot of work with young poets there. And so next week, last week of July, I'll be there doing work with teen poets, helping them get their thoughts on paper. And I'm doing a whole lot more work this coming year with El Otro Lado out of the Academy for the Love of Learning. I think I'll be in Amy Bill School in Santa Fe. So I'm trying to do more in Santa Fe. And I actually am working with John Davis, who's the Santa Fe Poet Laureate, on a Renga project that he's doing. That's actually putting Renga, I believe, in the rail yard. And so those are like some cool projects coming up. But as far as public performances, I have a couple in Albuquerque. Most of them are like fundraisers for causes I support. So there's going to be an anti-climate rally. Hmm. Anti-climate. No, that's not good. I wish we were anti-climate. But a climate rally about climate change.
Yeah.
Next week through 350.org. And that's going to be in Albuquerque. And I'm going to do a poem there that I wrote a little while ago for the Sierra Club and for something called the Seeds Collective. And yeah, so I'm around.
And you host a show on the local PBS?
I do. So if anybody gets a chance to catch it, I am one of the new faces for the Colores program on New Mexico PBS, which in Albuquerque is Channel 5. But we just did Ken Rodriguez. My first episode, I was lucky enough, I was honored enough to host Lucy Tapajanzo, who's the Navajo Nation Poet Laureate and teaches at UNM. And we got a treat coming up for the next one. So all of that can be kind of found roughly at my site, Hakim B, H-A-K-I-M-B-E, the first two letters of my last name, .com. But for PBS, you can actually see the episodes at their New Mexico PBS website.
Okay, Hakim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Unless you have another request, Joey.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate your work.
Okay, and next week we'll be back again. Looks like our summer break is over here at the Weekly Word. I'm Matthew Reichbach. I'm editor of nmtelegram.com.
And I'm Joey Peters at the Santa Fe Reporter, sfreporter.com. Tune in next week.